Hey, y'all, it's The Takeaway for July 2nd. I'm Arun Venugopal, in for Tanzina. Tourism is taking an environmental toll, and some travelers are trying to vacation responsibly.
I travel extensively, and so I am very concerned about the footprint.
I have purchased carbon offsets when I have traveled in Europe and Australia.
When we travel abroad, we always choose a resort that's eco-friendly.
Plus, we're taking your calls on the best summer songs at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
A great summer song has to be something that sounds amazing while you're driving, preferably driving to the pool or the beach.
And Grubhub is buying up thousands of web addresses for local restaurants, making it harder for them to grow online. All right, time to begin. Let's go on a trip. Going somewhere this week? You are obviously not alone. Across the globe, tourism is on the rise.
Go to Bombay, Taipei, Mandalay, Bora Bora, Kowloon, Cameroon, Brigadoon, to the moon. Let's go everywhere, man.
According to the World Tourism Organization, 2018 saw a record 1.4 billion international tourist arrivals. And our planet is feeling it.
It's so damn hot.
By some estimates, global tourism accounts for nearly 10% of the world's carbon emissions. And with more travelers continuing to head to the skies, tourism is going to be a piece of the climate change puzzle for years to come. Some of you told us you're thinking about climate change as you make your travel plans.
Hi, this is Luana Rubin in Boulder, Colorado. I travel extensively, and so I am very concerned about the footprint that my travel could leave on the planet. So I try to sign up for trips and tours that make a point of having a small footprint and that is sustainable.
Hi, this is Amy from Traverse City, and we just took a trip to LA area, and I carried coffee mug and a water bottle, and none of us used cups on the plane. We used the metro scooters and bicycles, which was awesome to get around town. So our rental car sat for 3 days untouched.
Hi, my name is William. I'm calling from Los Angeles, and I have purchased carbon offsets when I have traveled in Europe and Australia. They were between $3 and $10 per leg of my flight, and I've looked for them on U.S. flights, and it's not an option. I would definitely buy them if they were available.
Hi, this is Sarah calling from Lansing, Michigan. We always tell our kids we don't ever take a vacation from recycling. If we're going someplace remote, we plan to bring all of our recycling back with us. When we travel abroad, we always choose a resort that's eco-friendly. It's very important to us.
What does responsible tourism actually look like at this moment of climate change urgency? I'm Arun Venugopal, in for Tanzina Vega, and we're going to talk about it on The Takeaway. I have two people with me to talk through this. Martha Honey is co-founder and executive director of the Center for Responsible Travel, and she's also the editor of a book called Cruise Tourism in the Caribbean. And Jeremy Smith is a writer and tourism consultant and author of the book Transforming Travel. Welcome to you both.
Hey there, Aaron.
Martha, let's start with the numbers here. Exactly how big is the tourism industry today?
There's 1.4 billion people traveling internationally this year. It's expected to reach 2 billion by 2030 or before. And it is one of the few industries that's continued to grow year after year despite economic downturns.
Okay, we've been seeing this term come into parlance, over tourism. Has the industry grown too rapidly?
I think so. What we've seen is a convergence of a number of different trends within the industry, ranging from the growth of cruise tourism and Airbnbs to cheaper air flights, the growth of the middle class, the entry in big numbers of countries like China and India into the international travel market, social media, the sort of selfie culture and bucket list culture. All of these are contributing to people going to specific places and causing what is known as over-tourism, and also the lack of management by governments. That's a very important piece of it.
So how much do we know about the impact of all this travel on the climate?
Well, we know quite a bit. The exact figures of CO2 or greenhouse gas emissions are somewhat unclear for the tourism industry. It's somewhere up around 10%, with air travel contributing substantially and cruise tourism also contributing substantially. And we've also seen that the tourism industry is extremely vulnerable to climate change. The most popular type of vacation is along the coasts, on beaches. And so this is the most built-up sector of the tourism industry and also is extremely vulnerable to climate change.
Jeremy, at the individual level, tell us more about the biggest drivers of climate change in terms of tourism. We're talking about air travel. What else?
Well, I mean, I think we can't go on to the what else without making it very clear that it is primarily air travel. And as Martha said, I mean, it varies obviously depending on how far you fly, but it's somewhere between 50, 70, 80% of an individual trip. And so once we move beyond the flight, then there is the accommodation, the food one buys, the way one gets around. But they are a small piece of the pie compared to the transport that gets us there and back.
So tell us a little more about how much carbon an average international trip emits and what it takes to offset that.
Okay, well, I'm sitting here in London. A return flight between London and New York in economy class, it's going to depend upon how new your plane is, but it's looking at 1.5, 1.6, 1.7 tons of carbon dioxide per person, which is still hard to really visualize. But I think there was a report from Nature Climate Change last year that said that each person on a return trip, London to New York, accounts for 32 square feet of melting Arctic sea ice.
Wow. Now, a lot of environmental activists have expressed skepticism about carbon offsets. What is your take on them? Should individuals take on the responsibility here, and are they effective?
The idea that by paying for an offset, somehow my flight's impact upon the environment is removed is wrong. And that is the prime reason that people are resistant to the idea that carbon offsets neutralize a flight. And there are multiple reasons for that, to do with whether you're planting trees that are going to take decades to grow and absorb the carbon, whether you can actually ensure that the project was going to happen regardless, and various other things to do with how well you'd ensure the project will be maintained and will continue to deliver what it's doing. That said, do I believe that someone who is causing pollution to the atmosphere shouldn't do some form of remedial work to do it? Yes, I do believe so. I mean, put it this way, I offset the flights, the trips I take, and whatever else I consider in my life has a significant carbon impact. But I don't consider that's the final thing I do. I do everything I can to minimize. And when I'm left going, you know what, that's what's left, then I offset.
Martha, what efforts are we seeing within the industry, the tourism industry, namely with major companies? What are they doing to tackle the reality of climate change, if anything?
Right. I mean, all companies are working on reducing their fuel costs. It's the largest cost that they have in airplanes, and they're trying to make more fuel-efficient airplanes. There are a number of experimentations with also trying to develop non-fossil fuel consuming planes. And there was actually in 2016, I believe, the first round-the-world flight by a solar-powered plane. I mean, a very, very small one-person plane, but still it made it around the world. So there are efforts underway. I think the industry can do much more. I think governments need to be pushing the industry to do much more, and consumers need to be. And I totally agree with Jeremy that carbon offset is not going to solve the problem of pollution by planes, because what you're doing is you're paying another company, basically, or another organization to do something green on behalf of the airline industry. We have to keep the pressure on the airline industry. But I also think that it's very important to remember that we should not completely stop flying, because tourism is the most important foreign exchange earner for developing countries around the world, along with oil. And we know that oil is not a good alternative, at least tourism done well, done responsibly, has the capacity to do some good in countries. So I think we have to continue to fly, but we have to figure out ways to do it in smarter ways, take longer haul trips and stay longer in those destinations rather than a whole series of long haul trips, use alternative transport, as Jeremy mentioned, whenever possible, and so on. But we need to keep seeing the world, both because it's important to developing countries and it's important to our education.
So you think that there is a case to be made for improving the quality in terms of the sustainability of the tourism. Do you think that is inevitably going to be more expensive for the individual tourist?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. I mean, certainly the research and development of green planes is expensive. Perhaps at the end of the day, they'll end up being cheaper than fossil fuel planes. I don't think we know that yet. And certainly as they come online and we get more and more of them, then the price will inevitably go down, as we always see. I think we simply need to keep the pressure on the industry. We've seen, for instance, within tourism over the last 20, 25 years, the growth of a whole variety of eco-certification programs. But most of them are for accommodation, not for transport. And so we need to be trying to develop standards, green standards for transport as well.
Jeremy, given what you've told us about carbon emissions of flights, could campaigns to keep people from traveling altogether be part of the solution?
There are these campaigns, these sort of flight shame campaigns and Flight Free 2020 in the UK and Europe that are happening. I think they are a part of the solution. But I think we have to be careful. I mean, as you said in your question, you said you shifted from saying flights to travel. I don't think we should be stopping people from travel. I think travel is an incredibly important part of who we are as humans. But we don't necessarily need to be designing a life which involves a quick weekend flight here and there back and forth to Europe, just to another city to go shopping. And a lot of the focus, backing up what Martha was just saying, on looking at how we might price this fairly, is to say we can't price the opportunity for a holiday out of the reach of those, everyone except for the very wealthy. But some form of fair taxation, they're talking about a way that the first flight has no tax. The second time, the tax increases. The third flight of a year, the tax increases even more. So the people who frequently fly are being made to pay the most. But those who get one chance for a dream holiday actually potentially make it more available to them.
Martha, you've argued that people who travel do actually care more about climate change. Tell us more about that. How does it work?
Well, I think we're seeing, you know, it's taken time, but there's been now a couple of generations where the terms like ecotourism and sustainable tourism, responsible travel have been part of our lexicon. And we've had standards being developed through certification programs. So it is, you know, filtering down to the traveling public. And I think also we're seeing, particularly with millennials, that there's a real interest in environmental protection and a real concern. And the urgency, of course, is being driven by climate change and also by over-tourism. I do think that you put your finger on one of the real dilemmas, which is how, at a time when we definitely are going to have some limitations on travel, particularly to certain places, destinations, and areas, how do we keep travel democratic? And I think in addition to what Jeremy said about people who travel more by plane paying more in taxes, there are other techniques that are being talked about, reservation systems for key museums, key national parks, and other attractions around the world where people have to sign up beforehand. The good thing about this is that when they get there, it will not be overcrowded because the numbers will be controlled by a limited number of tickets, but it will be a first-come, first-served basis so that it can be open to people of a range of different economic capacities. So I think we have to think creatively about how we keep, as we have to constrain the number of tourists going to specific areas, how we also keep the processes we put in place democratic, and we don't simply do it by raising the price.
Jeremy Smith is a writer and tourism consultant and author of the book Transforming Travel. And Martha Honey is co-founder and executive director of the Center for Responsible Travel. Thank you both.
Thank you, Arun.
I never dreamed you'd leave in summer.
Hey folks, Arun Vanagopal in for Tanzina this week on The Takeaway. There's been a lot of really difficult news lately, but the calendar officially says July, summer's in full swing, so let's take a second to relax, and that means music. So we asked you to tell us about your anthem of the summer so far, music that's making you feel good, and just what makes it so great.
A great summer song has to be something that sounds amazing while you're driving. an amazing summer song is something you envision you and your whole crew like starring in the music video. Not being in the video, but starring in the video. And I'm not sure if a summer song has emerged yet this summer, but I'm listening to Ocean Drive.
We're riding down the boulevard.
Kind of checks all my boxes. It's fun. It reminds me of Miami with my friends. And it's very danceable. It's a few minutes. I've got it on a heavy loop. This is Jay calling from Jerry Hill.
My favorite summer song, I just heard it, and it's Everybody Wants to Rule the World. I just love that song, and every time I hear it, I think of summer because of the guitar playing and the light, airy way that the music flows. It is a wonderful song. My name is Jennifer, and I'm from Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Hello, my name is David from La Habra. I remember Summertime by Will Smith.
Think of the summers of the past. Adjust the bass and let the alpine blast. Pop in my CD and let me run a rhyme. And put your car on cruise and lay back, cause it's summertime.
That year when it came out, my grandfather took me and my two other cousins on a two-week road trip. One of my cousins had the single and played it many times, and we loved it. We loved it as young kids. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak, and Will Smith, shout out to you.
This is Carl in Bend, Oregon. We always hit Tom Petty for lots of great road tunes, and Into the Great Wide Open is absolutely our favorite to launch our trip.
The sky was the limit.
We start playing that, and we all yell blast off at the same time.
Into the great wide open.
My name is Lee, and I'm calling from North Bergen, New Jersey. I'd say the best summer anthem is Palamore. Whenever I hear this song, I'm transported to an epic cinematic rooftop party in Rome, a la the opening scene in La Grande Bellezza.
My favorite summer jam is Back to 1999 by Charlie XCX and Troye Sivan. It mentions jamming out to Britney Spears, and it's the year that my sister was born, so it makes me a little weepy. I'm Jet Turner, and I'm in Denver, Colorado.
I remember back home, best friends all night, no phone, no cares, I was dumb and so young.
All right, good stuff. My pick, well, that would be Hot Fun in the Summertime by Sly and the Family Stone.
End of the spring, and here she comes back.
As far as I'm concerned, there is no better example of a song that hits at just how beautiful and fleeting summers are, how quickly they come and go. I've always thought that about this song. It's always been really poignant to me, but especially so this year because my kid, she just turned 18. It's over before you know it. Tell us your summer anthem, tweet us at The Takeaway, or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And we will have a playlist for you at thetakeaway.org of all the songs you told us are making you happy this summer. It's The Takeaway.
I'm Amy Walter. You might be familiar with my work at the Cook Political Report or as a contributor to the PBS NewsHour. But you're hearing me now because I'm host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, we get behind the chaotic headlines from Washington and tell you how policies in this country are actually changing and how it could affect you. Join me each week on Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
If you, like many of us, order takeout from time to time, there's a good chance you use a delivery app. Grubhub, Uber Eats, DoorDash, Caviar. More and more apps seem to be appearing every other week. And while these apps may be convenient for customers, they've also been raising the fees they charge restaurants over the years, making it harder for establishments to stay in business and to turn a profit. Now, a recent investigation shows another way the company can influence the sales of independent restaurants. Claire Brown, a staff writer at The New Food Economy, reports that Grubhub has bought thousands of web addresses for small local restaurants, often without the consent of those businesses. Claire is on the line now. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So how did you first discover that Grubhub was buying up all these URLs?
Well, there was a hearing at New York City Council in City Hall, and a bunch of restaurateurs showed up to talk to council members about some of their grievances with Seamless and Grubhub. And this didn't actually come up in the public forum while I was there, but I got to talking to some restaurateurs, and one of them was saying that she had tried to bulk up her own website and found that Grubhub already owned her domain. And that was very striking to me, so I decided to dig a little bit further into it.
Now, in your article at The New Food Economy, you have gone into the problems of a particular restaurateur, a woman named Shivani. You don't even give her last name because apparently she has reason to sort of stay, I guess, a little under the radar. Tell us about Shivani, though, the kind of restaurant she runs and this burden that she's now facing that has to do with Grubhub.
Shivani runs two restaurants, both in the city. They're kind of American-style lunch spots. It's burgers, egg sandwiches, and she decided recently that she wanted to get off of Grubhub, and she did that because she joined Grubhub several years ago, and nothing else has changed about her business. She has more customers than ever before. Everything else is the same, but she realized that she was falling behind on bills. And so she did a deep dive into her finances to try and figure out where the money was going, right? She went into her Grubhub statements and she realized that she had just been slowly paying more and more to the platform over time. So she decided she wanted to see if she could kind of strike out on her own. You know, she had all of this business, many, many loyal customers. She figured if she just launched her own website and ordering system, there should be no problem. Then she went to buy her domain name, which is the first step in setting up your own website, and she realized that Grubhub already owned it.
So just to put into perspective the amount of money she was paying to Grubhub, you report that she paid in a given month $7,000, which equaled pretty much her rent. So this is an extraordinary amount of money that's going to Grubhub, as you said, 30% of every receipt.
Yeah, and you know, that statement I reviewed was actually $8,000, so she had actually underestimated it just a little bit, which just goes to show you it's a huge proportion of their income. And there were a lot of charges that weren't necessarily fair. So Grubhub has a practice of charging restaurants for calls that come in through the app. The problem is not every single one of those calls actually leads to an order. And this came up a lot in the hearings. People felt like it was unfair that they were being charged basically for any phone call longer than 45 seconds, and the Grubhub executives were claiming that it's the responsibility of the restaurant owner to go back in and listen to those calls and strike off the ones that didn't lead to an order.
Getting back to our story with Shivani, she decides she wants to sort of strike out on her own in a sense, go online, beef up her web presence, but she can't do this because Grubhub owns the URL for her restaurant name, correct?
Correct.
And so now what? What can she do?
Grubhub told me in a statement that it is their practice to immediately transfer a web domain over to anyone who asks. So she may be able to pursue that option. Otherwise, she's looking at purchasing a URL that doesn't match her restaurant as closely as she would like. And, you know, she's still feeling like it's an uphill battle. Once you build your own website, you have to beat Grubhub and Seamless in all of the Google search rankings, and that is no easy task. It turns out it's actually very, very difficult to have your own business show up on the internet sometimes.
Now, when they say they'll transfer upon request to the person who owns the business, is it clear whether there is some sort of financial payment that's required to obtain it?
You know, they issued that statement after we published, and so I haven't been able to ask Shivani about this. I have had restaurants on Twitter reach out to me and say, you know, I've been trying to get my URL for 8 months, and they're pretending they don't know what's going on. And so we'll see how that practice compares with reality as this story continues to unfold.
Why does Grubhub say they're doing this? What do they get out of this?
They positioned it to me as a marketing service. They said adding additional web presence creates more value for the restaurant, which in turn creates more orders, which in turn is better for everyone. And so they angled it as a marketing opportunity that they do on behalf of their restaurant customers. Mm-hmm. That said, no one that I spoke to for this story knew that this was happening.
All right. So the Grubhub told the Takeaway in a statement that they've gotten, quote, explicit permission from the businesses to register these domain names, but it sounds like your reporting does not bear that out.
Everyone I've talked to before and since the story was taken by surprise.
Let's step back for a second. Just how important are delivery apps to small independent restaurants like Shivani's? Do they need to use delivery apps to stay afloat in today's economy?
Shivani feels like she does need to use delivery apps, and I will give you an example. Most of us remember a time before delivery apps where we would pick up the phone and call a restaurant. Shivani used to make more than $1,000 in sales just on those phone calls every month. Now, she says, these apps have become the default for people who want to order. So they've really trained customers to think, I want takeout, I go to Grubhub, I go to Seamless. And Shivani feels like by exiting that system, she doesn't really know what will happen. And restaurants operate at such thin profit margins. They don't really have much room to play around and to experiment. It's a lot of the times just trying to stay afloat and pay the bills from month to month.
So let's say I Google a local restaurant, Claire, and I stumble on a website that looks like the restaurant's but is actually a Grubhub-owned site. What happens?
So this was another interesting thing we found in our investigation. Grubhub actually creates, they call them nano sites. They're basically little tiny websites that use stock photography and Grubhub templates, and they look like a real restaurant website. So what happens when you click on those is that Grubhub does get that commission that it's charging restaurants because the order is technically coming through Grubhub. The only problem is the customer often doesn't know that they're making a Grubhub order, especially if they pick up the phone and call, because that phone number will then forward to the restaurant's real phone number, and Grubhub will record the call and take the commission.
Claire Brown is a staff writer for The New Food Economy. Thanks so much, Claire.
Thank you for having me.
You can read the full comment that Grubhub sent to The Takeaway about the story online at thetakeaway.org. And for the restaurant owners in our audience, we would love to hear from you. Do you use delivery apps as part of your business? Does this sound familiar to you at all? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega. She'll be back in the host chair on Thursday.